the first refugee ever elected to Congress.
The machinery of democracy should work for everyone everywhere, not just in certain places and not just on a certain day.
Power sees nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. We still have to be willing to show up every single day and demand our seat at the table.
So f***ing proud of you guys.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 236. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am fantastic. I'm really, really excited about today's episode.
Is it because people are still waiting with bated breath to hear the answer to whether or not a corporation can be pardoned?
No, it is because we are going to reverse roles on today's episode, because this is a question where, but under which the legal analysis is pretty straightforward, but the musical analysis requires expertise that I don't have, but my amazing co-host does. So I'm super excited about this.
I'm excited to finally play Stairway and get all the girls. Like, was the plan all along in high school?
Oh, I have my iPhone out and the light on, and that's in one hand, and then I have the old school cigarette lighter in the other, and I'm just gonna say, Thomas, will you play Stairway for us?
No, Stairway denied.
Yeah, that's exciting. We're gonna follow up on the corporations or people. And maybe criminals from last week. And then we've got our main segment is going to be Spirit versus Led Zeppelin. Spirit is a band that you've probably never heard of. And Led Zeppelin is a band you probably have heard of. Because really interesting case involving potential plagiarism there with Led Zeppelin stealing from Spirit on this song that's kind of obscure. But anyway, it had at first been overturned, you know, denied, and then Andrew will explain the legal ins and outs, but everyone thought it was a done deal, and then all of a sudden on appeal, they figured out that the jury hadn't been instructed properly, so it's going back. So really interesting case there, and I had an idea to maybe turn the tables on Andrew a little bit and do like he did with You Be the Supreme Court a long time back, one of my favorite episodes where he took us all through the arguments kind of on one side and on the other. I thought, ooh, I can try to do that with this Spirit versus Led Zeppelin. So that's the goal. Hopefully it'll work out. So there you have it. That's our show. What do you think? Should we get to it?
I am super excited.
Unfortunately, some members of the media.
Some members of the media.
Some members of the media.
Some members of the media use their platforms
to push their own personal bias. To push
their own
agenda.
To control
what people think.
All right, Andrew, is CEO David Pecker on the hook for criminal charges when it comes to National Enquirer? And can Trump pardon a corporation? Everyone has been wanting to know the answers to these questions. Spill the beans.
So, yeah, okay, let's. Here are the answers. Number one, yes, Pecker is still on the hook. Although, given that the conduct attributed to the National Enquirer is his conduct, and he's the primary person who is acting on behalf of AMI in complying with the plea arrangement, I would be surprised to see the special counsel's office bring subsequent individual charges against Pecker, unless there's something else out there, and there may be, right? So this does not, the answer is this does not prevent the special counsel's office from bringing charges against Pecker. I would add the same DOJ guidelines about indicting a corporation. This is Article 12A, specify that prosecutors generally should not agree to accept a corporate guilty plea in exchange for non-prosecution or dismissal of charges against individual officers and employees. And you can understand that. And again, that's only, you know, sort of tangentially related because, you know, you get that the major thrust of that is you don't want to have a corporation plead guilty to a criminal offense in order to get all of its officers out of jail time, right? That's meant to cover that situation. But but taken literally, it would also imply that this deal was not meant to get Pecker off the hook.
Yeah. All right, interesting. So finally, though, can you pardon a corporation? I mean, corporations are people, my friend. So what do you think? I feel like it's got to be no, but I don't know.
I think the answer is yes.
Ooh.
And I think the answer is yes for a couple of reasons, but I want to be clear that I don't know that anyone's ever asked this question before.
Wow.
I did a ton of research on this. Here are the three reasons why I think the answer is yes. Okay. The first is that the constitutional power to pardon is set forth in Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution. And it says, the president shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. Right.
Hmm.
So it doesn't even say persons.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I don't think, right, you know, you want to make, again, another argument about how originalists aren't really originalists. I highly doubt that the founding fathers were thinking about the president pardoning corporations. But there's no intrinsic limitation in the presidential pardon power. There then are three ways that this has been implemented that I think suggest that a presidential pardoning power would extend to corporations. And here are those three arguments, right? The first is, it is well established that the president can issue executive orders directing the Attorney General, directing the Department of Justice to exercise prosecutorial discretion against corporations. And the classic example of that was under Bill Clinton, the DOJ enacted a corporate leniency policy. It was meant to encourage corporate whistleblowers. It was described as corporate immunity. And it said, we will not prosecute a corporation as well as their directors, officers, and employees if the corporation is the first to come forward and report illegal antitrust activity. And then, you know, do other stuff. And so the power to exercise prosecutorial discretion is different than the pardoning power, right? Like I don't mean to suggest that it's the same question, but they often show up in analyses together. So that's sort of point one. The president can exercise prosecutorial discretion over corporations as well as real persons. Point two is I found at least one example. And only one example. I'm sure there are more, but I looked really hard for this, and I could only find one example of where a governor has pardoned a corporation. And in this case, it was Alaska Governor Frank Murkowski. I believe that's Lisa Murkowski's dad, right? The Murkowski family, longstanding Alaska politicians. He pardoned a company called the Whitewater Engineering Corporation. And what happened was one of their employees, Gary Stone, was killed in an avalanche in Alaska. Prosecutors charged the corporation and its president with manslaughter because they allegedly the employees.
His name? Paul Oot the Planet.
Yeah, exactly. And ultimately, the charges against the officer were dropped. The company pled no contest to a charge of criminally negligent homicide and was then pardoned by Governor Murkowski. So at least one governor has done this. Interestingly, I tried to pull up the article. This is if we have any Alaskan listeners that happen to have old copies of the Anchorage Daily News lying around, send them my way.
I'm sure that's only half our listeners. So
yeah,
might be kind of tough.
This article was December 24th, 2006. It's actually misreported in court filings as being 2007. But it's not online. It is the December 24th, 2006 A1 page of the Anchorage Daily News, written by Megan Holland. And it says that it reports that Governor Murkowski pardoned the company. So that's sort of point two. I think that's a really strong argument. And then point three is that you can effectively, even if you couldn't pardon a corporation, you could pardon every single member of that corporation.
Oh, interesting.
And then effectively get around it.
Well, but wouldn't they still be, wouldn't the corporation still possibly be liable, though? How would that work?
You would think, but there is, in fact, a case on that point, on that very point. Took me a lot to find this because this case is from 1885.
Wow.
It is the Board of Field Officers versus the United States. And roughly speaking, there was a South Carolina corporation that was formed, the Board of Field Officers of the 4th Brigade of South Carolina Militia. And it was a company that was formed to purchase certain land to train the South Carolina State Militia. Everybody involved with that then were traitors to the United States and fought on the side of the Confederacy. The United States occupied that land. And then the question was, after the Civil War and after blanket amnesty was given to, traitors against the Union during the Civil War, did the United States have to pay rent to this corporation when, you know, its officers were traitors during the Civil War, but had all been pardoned, you know, given blanket amnesty. And the Supreme Court said essentially that the officers have been pardoned. Oblivion is thrown over all their disloyal acts. It is as if such acts have never been committed.
Wow.
Since these acts cannot be invoked against the person who committed them, can they be invoked against a corporation of which they were the officers? If the corporation is to be charged with the offense of its officers, should it not be credited with their pardons? The sin of the officers works a legal effect in the corporation. The sin is pardoned, but the effect is not. The sinners can come to this court, but the corporation, sinless, devoid of moral qualities, cannot. We think the position, by 19th century Supreme Court opinions were great, weren't they? We think the position involves a question in ethics too subtle for practical adjudication.
Oh, wow.
If you pardon all of the officers and directors of a corporation, that pardon is attributable to the corporation.
Fast forward to some, like, you know, oil company polluting the planet.
Polluting,
Trump,
yes.
Trump pardoning everybody in it, or maybe just pardoning the corporation.
So we'll there you go. Ultimately,
very interesting.
I think that that's your out.
All right. Well, now it is time for a little music. Time to get to our spirit.
Can't wait. This, I've been waiting for this all week.
So, Andrew, Spirit versus Led Zeppelin. What's going on here? Give us the legal history breakdown.
Okay. This is something that lawyers have known about for 4.5 years now, because in 2014, the trustee for the Randy Craig Wolf Trust, also known as Randy California, not somebody I had ever heard of before, the lead singer of the band Spirit, filed a complaint against Led Zeppelin that is, remember the what counts as having a sense of humor among lawyers is a pretty low bar. And so this got disseminated widely, right? Because the plaintiff's attorney in this case filed this complaint, used the Led Zeppelin font for his headings, signed the complaint in red ink. It's pretty cool. I'm going to link it in the show notes.
Huh.
And the allegation is that Led Zeppelin stole the iconic song "Stairway to Heaven" from Randy California's band Spirit. It is buttressed by several really interesting factual allegations. Led Zeppelin opened for Spirit in 1967. Spirit played the song that they claim that Stairway to Heaven is stolen from. It's a song called Taurus. the bull, the constellation. So, you know, you get you get the sense of what kind of band Spirit is, right?
Yeah, you would never know it was right out of the late 60s. You'd never have any idea. Right. Could be today.
There may have been some chemical substances that were imbibed.
That's part of the problem with this lawsuit is it took until now till everybody was finally off their, like, you know, the trip. They're like, what happened? Oh, they stole that song from the late 60s.
Yeah, well, no, look, like, that actually is an important legal question that we're going to sidestep a little bit. It wasn't until, yeah, I mean, it's a perfectly valid question to say, isn't 2014 a bit late to be litigating whether Stairway from 1971 was stolen from Taurus in 1968, right? Like, aren't there statutes of limitation? And the answer is that the Supreme Court clarified in a 21st century opinion that each and every republication constitutes a new infringement for purposes of statutes of limitation.
Yeah, I'm sure this thing's getting re-released all the time, you know, the remastered version or the compilation or something like that.
Yeah, and every time a radio station plays Stairway.
Oh,
right,
it would even be that? Just any time a radio? Okay.
Fresh infringement. So that's
smell
how,
that, everybody? Fresh infringement.
The reason, so anyway, amazing complaint, filed, transferred some procedural stuff, and then it went to a jury, and it went to a jury after being transferred to California, and the jury found, going to upload the jury verdict form in January of 2016. So again, before we did the show, something I never thought I'd get a chance to talk about. Question number one, do you find by a preponderance of the evidence that plaintiff is the owner of a valid copyright in the musical composition Taurus? Right. Answer, yes. Okay. If your answer is yes, question number two, do you find by a preponderance of the evidence that any of the defendants, that is Led Zeppelin, had access to the musical composition Taurus before Stairway to Heaven was created? Answer, yes. Mm-hmm. Right. If that's next question, question number three, who had it? And the answer was both Jimmy Page and Robert Plant. Little check marks next to it. Question number four, do you find by a preponderance of the evidence that the original elements of the musical composition Taurus are extrinsically substantially similar to Stairway to Heaven? Answer, no.
Okay.
And that's it. And so the jury says, 2016, sorry, we just don't get it. We don't think Stairway is similar to Taurus. So that's it. And, you know, I kind of thought that would be it because in general, again, I hadn't dug into the merits of the lawsuit until just now. But in general, opening arguments listeners know that when you have a factual question, the review of that factual question is for abuse of discretion on appeal. It's a very, very high standard. And so I thought, look, like, it's not like the Ninth Circuit is going to go, oh, come on. They sat right. Like, but in fact, the Ninth Circuit was asked to address certain procedural irregularities in the trial. In particular, the plaintiffs were not allowed to play various versions of Taurus at the trial. They were required to rely on the what's called the deposit copy of the copyright, which is the sheet music. Right. It now it includes audio recordings, but because this is before 1978, it was the sheet music. And so they played this bass clef version. I don't really know what that means, so I'm going to defer to you on that one. And so the plaintiffs argued on appeal that the evidentiary exclusions and the jury instructions prejudicial, that they should have been entitled to an instruction about the scope of copyright, that the scope of copyright for musical elements includes aggregating together otherwise non-copyrightable elements, right? And think about that outside of music. It's really, really easy to picture that, right? Like, if I have a logo that is comprised of geometric shapes, right? Like, I can't copyright a triangle,
right? Yeah, yeah.
Right? But I could copyright, you know, a triangle with an overlapping circle with inside a square, right? Like in a particular arrangement of non-copyrightable elements. The same thing is true for music. And so anyway, the Ninth Circuit just ruled substantially in favor of Randy California. There are pending motions for a rehearing en banc and some other stuff. But one way or another, this case on Stairway to Heaven is the next step, because I think it's unlikely they're going to get a rehearing en banc, is going to be a petition for cert to the Supreme Court. So Stairway may be going to the Supreme Court.
Oh, wow.
I'm super excited
and
about it.
Assuming Randy California's family or whatever, because he's deceased, but assuming that side is successful, then it would be, what, a retrial because the jury was not instructed properly? Or
yep, that's exactly
okay,
right.
I was going to say, it's not as though they get all the damages or something. It's just that they have to redo it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So preliminary question, I hinted into it. So the Ninth Circuit says the Taurus recording that was played for the jury only contained the bass clef and excluded the treble clef, which contained additional notes.
What?
What in the hell does that mean?
Well, so that to me makes no sense because I don't know how to, if you want me to launch into what I wanted to say here, but
yeah,
I don't get that. So I ran into something similar. I was doing a bunch of research for this because I'm so interested in this topic and whether songs are ripoffs of other songs or whatever. And there was a similar thing that happened in the Blurred Lines lawsuit. Mm-hmm. Which I can't start talking about, otherwise I'll start yelling about how horrible of a song that is. However, I saw a similar sentence where it said, oh, due to some quirks in copyright law, they're actually only able to have the sheet music, like the sheet music itself is the thing that you're infringing. And I found that a little confusing. So I was going to throw that back at you at like why that is. But it sounds like you're saying prior to a certain year, that was the only thing you could copyright. And then subsequently, now you can like copyright the whole, you can include the actual audio. Is that what it is?
Well, it's actually a bit more complicated than that.
Oh,
I wasn't sure we were going to go down this rabbit hole, but super briefly.
Okay, sure. Go ahead.
Here's the thing. The deposit copy is the proof of the thing that you're copywriting, that you deposit with the U.S. Copyright Office, right? And so back when recordings sucked, the deposit copy was the sheet music. Subsequently, like now, you know, a digital recording of the song is as good a copy as the digital copy of the sheet. You know what I mean? So, you know, there's no real distinction. So today, the deposit copy of a musical composition that has been published is to have two complete copies of the best edition of the song. But in the past, it was just...
So
you've got to.
But the thing you said sounds like nonsense. Could you answer me that this might still be a law question? Otherwise, it's nonsense. Why on earth would they be limited to the bass clef and not the treble clef? If you're looking at sheet music can include easily both a bass and treble clef. There's no reason. There's no musical reason why that makes any sense. So is there some law reason why you'd only have the bass clef?
Yes. And here's why, because one of the evidentiary issues on which the Ninth Circuit reversed had to do with how often and what version of the song Taurus plaintiffs could play in the courtroom, right? Mm-hmm. You can imagine that as you're selecting what to play, right, that's going to greatly influence what the jury thinks, right? That's what we're going to do on this episode. And early on, the trial judge ruled that they could only play the deposit copy version, right? And so,
but I thought you said that was just
sheet no. Music. I'm gonna get there. Gotcha. I realize this, right? So, so then, what Randy California's lawyer tried to do, this is pretty clever, was because he also wanted to play various subsequent live performances of Taurus, because apparently when you play it live, when they played it live, it sounded even more Stairway-esque, right? That's not
okay.
It's not
we'll get
in the
to that,
circuit,
but all right, yeah, sure,
right. But it seems to be from reading between the lines, and the trial court judge said, no. You're limited. Your copyright is just a copyright on the deposit version, so we're not going to let you.
Well, and that makes sense to me because subsequently, after Stairway becomes a gigantic song, like maybe they. You know, in a live performance, you know, people do this all the time.
But these are live performances that are pre-Stairway.
Oh, okay.
So Taurus is 68.
Gotcha.
Stairway is 71. They wanted to play live versions from 69 and 70.
Okay. Right? Gotcha.
And so what the lawyer for Randy California wanted to do was play various versions of the song while cross-examining Jimmy Page ask, have you heard this version of the song, and to say, look, we're not playing this for the jury to measure substantive similarity. We're playing this for.
It's almost like the questions we've had where, like, you can use notes or whatever. Like, please look at your notes and refresh yourself. And it's not like you have to enter the notes into evidence. Is it that exact
thing? It's similar. It's also similar to you can introduce hearsay if you're introducing it not for the truth of the statement, but for some other purpose. Right.
Ah,
so
okay.
It was pretty clever. The trial court excluded that on a 403, which is that the prejudicial value would outweigh its probative value. And the Ninth Circuit reversed and said, no, you should have been able to play. And so what they did, what the trial court did, which, I think was a pretty clever solution, said, no, you can play the song clips for Jimmy Page outside the presence of the jury and then ask him about it in front of the jury. Right. So that was the way that the trial court judge split the baby. The Ninth Circuit said that was not sufficient. So they reversed on that issue. As a result of all of this, during jury deliberations, the jury asked to hear both, and they had somebody just like you, Thomas, come in and play both songs, right? Because they're playing off the sheet music, and the jury said, "We want to hear both Taurus and Stairway to Heaven." And then the judge said, "Do you want to hear the deposit copy version or the version with only the bass clef?"
Don't understand why only the bass clef. What? Maybe I missed it, but where is the part where it's the bass clef and not the bass and treble clef?
Because the bass clef is one of the versions that was played for Page by plaintiff's counsel. So in other words, because apparently when you get rid of the treble clef is the other one. Okay, I'm trying to pick up here. When you get rid of it and you only play the bass clef, apparently there are stronger similarities.
Oh, if you right. only... So this would matter more for Stairway, in my musical opinion, than Taurus, because one of the points I'm going to make is that there's more... You know, the higher line in Stairway is different. And so if you got rid of that in Stairway and just looked at the bass clef in Stairway, then it would be more similar. But I don't...
Got it.
As a musician, this is not making sense to me, but it sounds like it's some weird legal... thing that you have to translate this into how the law looks at it. And then, but okay. The point is they're going to possibly, if it goes all the way to the Supreme Court, or if it doesn't, I guess they could just say, yeah, they made the right decision. Right. And then it could
we're
get
gonna,
another.
We're, yeah. So the Supreme Court, I think, will very likely deny cert unless, I mean, you know, the composition of the Supreme Court right now, since it's all, you know, 40 and 50 year old conservatives, they might be like, yeah, we want a Stairway case. You know, just, you know, kind of picture Brett
just
Kavanaugh,
to get a live concert, free live concert. Yeah. make Jimmy Page play for you.
Yeah, but unless they are tickled by the notion of taking up the Led Zeppelin case, I think they're very likely to deny cert. Either way, it's headed back for a trial. So in 2019, what we do here is what another jury is going to hear.
Well, okay. So, we should have, maybe I should have done this early on, but I was going to just play real quick the studio versions of each. Just like 5-10 seconds, so that people even have, because I'm guessing not a lot of people know the song Taurus by Spirit other than from this lawsuit. So here's the, we'll start with Stairway. Everybody knows Stairway, but just a refresher. I'll play the first few seconds.
Play Stairway.
Okay. So So keep that in your head. That's the studio version of Stairway, and then we'll go to Taurus. Hopefully I'll get the right spot here. Here's the song by Spirit. This is about 36 seconds in. So there, you've heard the songs, and I don't know what that sounds like to you, Andrew, because sort of like sometimes you won't know how a legal thing will sound to me. I don't know what that sounds like to you, but I thought I'd start, and again, I want to emphasize, I don't know how in researching this myself, I'm worried that the law around this can be really, really arbitrary, and the Blurred Lines case, in my opinion, was a horrible decision. When they ruled that Blurred Lines was copying a Marvin Gaye song. But that's a separate topic I can't really get to. So the point is, I don't know how the law will look at this. But I thought, you know, like I know something about music. This is something I do, all the music for all the shows. And I know more theory than your average, like, just garage band player. You know, I'm pretty okay at music theory. And so I thought, if I were the musicologist that they called to the stand, how would I look at this? And then I thought, ooh, I'm going to turn the tables on Andrew and sort of present both arguments. So I want to start, you know, stuff in favor of them being the same, I guess. Stuff in kind of on that side. So you already said one thing, which is, you know, they toured together, they played together. So we know there's that kind of causal connection, and the fact that Spirit, the Taurus by Spirit, is predates it, 1968 versus 1971. So there's some links there. And then I'm pretty sure even, you know, any novice or non-musician can pick out the similarity in how they sound. And it's the same progression. So it's if you can hear this here, it's... So that's the Taurus. And then I think Taurus goes here. And Stairway to Heaven would be... So I want to point out that I never learned Stairway before that. I'm glad this has given me the opportunity, because by the time I was in high school or college playing guitar, it was like, all right, Stairway's the song everyone learned. Come on, you got to learn something different than that. So I never bothered to learn it, even though I actually love Led Zeppelin. So I'm glad. Thank you, Andrew, for giving me the opportunity to finally be the guy on the acoustic guitar who's like, here, I know this song. I can play this song. But you should hear those first notes especially. And that's why I was saying, if you're looking at the, I guess, bass clef, even though I would think this would all be on one clef, but maybe it's not. So same progression there. And then I wanted to add in, Andrew, see how you feel about this so far. It's played on actually the same place on the guitar. And what I mean by that is, this isn't a huge deal, but there are many, many ways to voice chords on instruments, you know, and on guitar, especially when... Guitar is kind of an interesting instrument, you know. There's a lot of ways you can play a chord. Like, I can play an E here, or I could play it here, or I could, you know, there's all kinds of different ways you could do stuff. I could play so this is the A minor is the first chord of the song. I could play it here, or I could play it there. See how that sounds a little different? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just the voice. It just has to do with how you voice it, and you know. It's interesting that they're both voiced exactly the same place. And what I think, here's what I maybe you wouldn't necessarily pick up on, maybe, but that I think is some compelling evidence, which has to do with the timing of it. So if we take this in four, you know, we got one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, and that's identical. And then they both, between the two songs, they both pause on the next progression and play this for a full four count. So it's like one, two, one, two, a two count for each of those changes. So, you know. And then they both, by the time they get to that F major seven-ish chord for both of them, they stay on that for a four count. I just think that's interesting. It's a pretty, you know, like normal thing to do, but it didn't have to be that way. You know, one of them could have stayed on this for two and then this for, you know, like it could have stayed on the first one for four count, could have gone to the next one, then the next. You know, there's a lot of different ways you could have done it. And I do think it's interesting that timing-wise, it's exactly the same for those first four chords. Hey, folks, need to cut in to tell you about our sponsor, Vistaprint. Not sure if you know this about me, but I have a podcast or two, and I also attend conferences, conventions, that kind of thing. And there are all kinds of people who I might want to network with, and I do try to maybe interview or form a professional relationship with. The way to help make those connections and also let people know that you're someone to be taken seriously and someone who is professional is to have a nice business card to hand them. And Vistaprint is a great way to make that happen. The difference between making that connection and not could be huge, but the price to be ready for all of that is $10. Because Vistaprint can give you that confidence to be ready to make an impression. Because you can get a custom card with the colors, the fonts, and the designs, and the images you choose. All for $10. With Vistaprint, you can create a truly professional, unique card in minutes. Upload your own design or start with one of the professionally designed options that Vistaprint offers. And they also have simple tools and a wide range of templates to choose from. Pick the paper stock, style, and the quantity that's right for you. You also choose your delivery speed, order and receive your cards in as few as 3 days. Vistaprint uses only carefully selected inks and responsibly sourced paper stocks. They have dozens of designs that are just right for your business. Add your logo, contact information with just a few clicks, and know you can use it all in your marketing going forward. Your satisfaction is 100% guaranteed, or they'll make it right, either by reprinting your order or offering a refund. Vistaprint wants you to do something great for your business right now, which is why our listeners will get 500 high-quality custom business cards starting at $9.99. Use code OA at Vistaprint.com. That's code OA at Vistaprint.com. One more time, OA at Vistaprint.com. Make it happen. So having said all that, how do you feel about it, Andrew? You be the musicologist here. How do you feel about that?
Okay. So I'm going to start my musicology career with the law, because of course I am. And the instruction. So let me say that this case, right, is just going before an ordinary jury, right, of people like me who may be total idiots when it comes to understanding anything music. The instruction that they're going to get from the judge in making a determination is going to ask them to apply two different tests under Ninth Circuit law. And those tests are the intrinsic test and the extrinsic test. Right? Huh. The extrinsic test is an objective comparison of protected areas of the work. So what you do is you break the work down into its constituent elements, and you compare those elements to determine whether they are substantially similar. So I feel like that's what you just did for me. And I would say, based on what you just did, that seems like those components, right? Those constituent mm-hmm. elements, right? The notes, the chords, where they're played, right, the
timing,
the voicing, the pausing, that seems substantially similar to me.
Yeah.
So I think that's what I would conclude with respect to that. The intrinsic test is a holistic one, right? It says whether the ordinary reasonable person, here I guess is me, would find the total concept and feel of the works to be substantially similar.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that actually comes from a Ninth Circuit decision in 2000 against Michael Bolton. So always the opportunity to have
reference call Bolton back to the Led Zeppelin Hall of Fame same, patron from last week. Why do I have to change my name? So the other Michael Bolton.
yes. The other Michael Bolton, whom I have had the pleasure of booing off the stage, but we've already told that story. Anyway, so applying the extrinsic test, I would say, yeah, that sounds okay. Substantially
now,
similar
that's
to me.
All right, it's very interesting. Now this expert's leaving the witness box, and now we got the other side's expert here, and I want to start talking about some other stuff. So if I were to look at points, kind of going the other way, hard to know where to start, but I'll start kind of small and work my way up. So what I think as a musician here, I think the upper line that Jimmy Page has. So you heard the Spirit Taurus song is just. And then I think it opens that note, actually. It's kind of hard to hear in the recording. And actually, you know, that might be one of the reasons they wanted to play the different recordings, is because it's actually kind of hard to hear some of the notes because of the horrible 60s recording of it. But when I hear, you know, Stairway and Jimmy Page, I hear, we've got that top line, the bum, bum, and then it goes down here. And I think that actually adds quite a bit to it to me. So like, if I were charting the chords of this, if I was just charting the song, it's, you know, A minor. And then this is like the spirit version, that there's only these three notes. So you could write it a couple different ways. I think it's an A, like minor, major, seven possibly. But with Stairway, with Led Zeppelin, you've got this.
I'm sorry, I just have to cut in when you say it's an A minor major. All I can think of is the like bit from Catch 22 of like major, 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 major. Like, what on earth is an A minor major?
So I can kind of explain. I don't know how interesting that is to people, but let me add in this. So when it's Stairway here, and you have that top note, that's a 9, and so it turns it from an A minor major 7 maybe to an A minor 9 major 7. So I think that adds a little bit of character that's not in the original one. But yeah, I don't know if it's worth explaining a minor major, but like a major seven chord is taking. So if I'm playing, I'll go to A just to. So if I'm playing A and I play major seven, it's taking the octave up of the root. Well, you can do it anywhere, but it's taking the root and it's flatting it. That's called a major seven when it's just down a half step. So that turns into. And then the minor part is, so that was a major chord. So when you're playing an A minor, you can do the same thing. So it's an A minor, but you are still playing the major seven, and the major seven is just a half step down. So that sounds like that.
I actually understood that. That was super cool. Thank you.
Cool. And then the 9 is that part at the top. So that turns into, so to me, that makes it a little different. So that's just a very minor thing. Ooh. Pun not intended, but a very small thing. But I, you know, I think it's a little important. And I picked out that second one because the one after that this just reinforces the root, so it doesn't change the character of the chord. Same with the third or fourth chord, whatever that is. So anyway, and then not to mention, by the way, when you play the Led Zeppelin version, now kind of moving on to bigger stuff that I'll come back to later. That's the first repetition. So we just played the very beginning. And then after this comes in what I think is a brilliant, you just heard a tiny bit of it there. I don't want to violate copyrights. I wasn't trying to play as little of it as possible. But anyway, a brilliant little recorder arrangement by unsung Led Zeppelin genius John Paul Jones, I think is perhaps the unsung hero of that band. Really beautiful, lovely recorder arrangement that he did. He played like, I think I want to say 4 or 5 recorders and wrote these harmonies. It adds so much to it that is nowhere in the song Taurus for me at all. The song Taurus, by the way, I don't want to, not to talk crap on that song. It goes different places, and is lovely, but there's a lot of additional stuff here that has nothing to do with that. And so that's point two there. And then what I think is also interesting is after that F major 7 chord in Stairway, and then in Taurus it's this. So again, you can voice stuff differently. That's actually a slightly different chord. But anyway, after that, they totally, they diverge. And they even diverge on the D chord. So like the chord before that, if we're going Taurus is this, Taurus goes here. So it kind of leaves that note in there, and Stairway goes here. So it's a slightly different chord there. And then here's where we get to more of the substance of what I would say if I were an expert on the stand. Many, many songs utilize this progression. Many songs. So I thought I'd do something here that might be interesting. We'll see how this turns out. But Andrew, I want to play a little progression that's from a song that I guarantee you and virtually 100% of our audience knows. And I want to see if you can get it. So here's the song. Do you know what that is?
I guess I would be terrible at name that tune. No, I don't.
Here, I'll add in the lyrics. Don't want to leave you now. I believe in how. Exactly same progression. Now the last chord is slightly different. So George went to this would be like a D7. There's something else in there that I'm blanking on, but it's something like that. But before that, it's literally the same progression and in the same key. Same progression, same key, voiced a little differently. It was kind of voiced how I said earlier, where it's more with more open notes. So that's that. If I would make the argument that if, you know, Led Zeppelin is ripping off Spirit for that one thing, then, you know, are they both? I'm not sure which came first exactly. They're actually around the same time. Something and the Taurus song. But anyway, no, I believe in how. I would argue that they're both kind of ripping off that, if anything. But really, what my actual argument would be is that this is a very, very, very common progression. It's taking, it's taking a chord of some kind. So in this case, the A minor, and it's just doing a chromatically descending downward line. So it's just taking this note and chromatically descending down. I mean, that's so common. So, and then playing the other notes the same. So there are a million songs that have that. And actually, there was another one that I found on a website that someone posted, like, oh, here's another song that kind of does that. I thought of the something one. I forget if I know this song now that they're all sounding the same. But so this is another one someone pointed out from 1969. So that's called like Ice Cream Dreams by Cartoon. Another obscure thing I've never heard. Anyway, the point is
that is very obscure.
Yeah, yeah. But someone pointed. I mean, it was it was if your song was recorded in 1969, that means it probably was something. It wasn't like everyone could just make any recordings they wanted. That means you got some sort of studio time or deal. But anyway, this is used all the time. Like this progression is not unique to these songs. And then I'd go on to say,
all right. So you did a bunch of things. Number one, I am totally with you. John Paul Jones, tremendous bassist, really, really underrated and unsung hero in Led Zeppelin. Even from somebody who, you know, I saw Plantin Page in the late 80s, nice. Early 90s, and I had the Honey Drippers album, and you know, also anyway. So you made a couple of points. And here I'm going to combine sort of the legal analysis and my lay juror analysis, right? The first two I would kind of put together, right? Which is number one, that Stairway has the high notes that Taurus doesn't have, right? Taurus plays the chromatic chord progression over and over again and then kind of wanders off into some other stuff. Stairway plays that chord progression, but in between each one, it has that higher note at the end. And I certainly, that's objectively true, right? I hear
right.
That.
And it's not to say that totally changed. You know, you can't probably take a Beatles song and then add some noodling on your high E string and call it a different song. But you know, it does change it a little bit. Is all I was trying to say.
Well, I hear that. And I think, again, as a juror here, I would sort of the seminal ruling in this area is the George Harrison versus the Chiffons.
Oh, I would love to talk about that someday.
Yeah. On My Sweet Lord versus He's So Fine. Right. And again, so I think that would cover kind of both these first two sort of points to the contrary. Right. Like, number one, it really was only those three notes, right? And it's more than three notes, I know, because there's some quarter notes that are strung together, but I'm demonstrating my juror musical ignorance here. But yeah. Basically, it's the dun-dun-dun versus, and I'm sure I'm doing that off-key, but right, it's in My Sweet Lord and He's So Fine. They're in different keys, and nobody contests that My Sweet Lord, right, because it's George Harrison, who's, you know, several billion times more talented than the Chiffons, does other stuff in the song.
We should have a separate content, a debate on this, because I absolutely think that's a ripoff of that song.
It is. And it was ruled to be a ripoff.
Yeah, I feel like it's the kind of thing where he just absorbed it and didn't realize, you know, that happens a lot, by the way, as a songwriter. Well, I was going to say, as a songwriter, that happens a lot, where you kind of, you hear something in your head and you're, oh, that sounds good, and you're never sure. In fact, it's a funny story about the Beatles again. I'm a huge Beatles fan. And when Paul wrote Yesterday, it kind of came to him, like most of it, he said, came to him like all at once, to the point, and it's such a beautiful song, in my opinion, to the point where he had to play it around. He played it for George Martin. He played it for all these people. He was like, is this already a song? You know, and they were going around for, I think, weeks of just like, it either just came to me or it's already something. And they ran it around, you know, does anybody recognize this? Like, is this already a song? And once they were satisfied, like, no, I guess it isn't a song. I guess I just came up with it. Then he wrote all the lyrics and stuff and did Yesterday. So kind of reminds me of that. Well, like sometimes stuff comes to you and you're not really sure where it came from.
Yeah, and in fact, right, that is the holding by which the Chiffon's lawsuit is typically cited. It was described as subconscious plagiarism, and that's true, right? Like it's harder to think about that in a literary work, but if you had an eidetic memory and accidentally reproduced large chunks of a classic novel that you'd read in your childhood, because you know you just remembered it, but you'd forgotten that you know you were stealing it from somewhere, and it seemed like your own words, that would be a copyright violation, right? It doesn't matter whether you've done it intentionally or subconsciously. So that's all correct. What I found most interesting was when you played the bit from Something, kind of for two reasons. The first is you just playing the bass line. I didn't recognize it at all because
that was
kind of
my plan. Yeah.
Yeah. The vocals transform that so much. Right. And so I sort of go back to the intrinsic test of, boy, when you strip out the vocals, that sounds like a completely different song. And then I would also add something, you know, it's on Abbey Road, so it's 1969. So maybe Randy California will bring, if he prevails here.
Yeah, I was actually trying to track that down, like, because yeah, I know there was some weirdness with the Beatles late where they didn't publish that. So, like, I think he had it written in 1968. So if that were to happen, I'm sure there would be some interesting fact-finding about, like, okay, when did George actually write the song and record? Because they did a bunch of... You know, they were in the studio all the time, kind of recording stuff for later. Maybe there would be some earlier version, but yeah.
Yeah, and again, remember, those facts are not contested in this case, mm-hmm. right? Everybody admits, you know, as obscure as Spirit is, right? Led Zeppelin toured for them, right? They heard the song. And in copyright, you know, you prove, you have to prove as the plaintiff seeking to prove a copyright violation that the defendant had access to the work.
Right.
Well,
that's interesting. Okay. So if hypothetically I live on a remote island somewhere, I've never seen civilization, but I also have a guitar and I happen to write like, you know, Hey Jude exactly. Or maybe I have a piano. like it's, I'm good. I'm just good. Cause there's no,
you're good. Right. The infinite number of monkeys can work out, you know, all the other, because copyright is meant to protect you from copying. And if you haven't seen the original work, you can't copy it. So yeah, absolutely. You must demonstrate that first criteria.
Well, that's interesting. Sorry, I don't want to take too much time on this, but I'm very interested in this issue. I would have thought it was the other way, sort of like you don't need intent, you know, as you were saying, you don't really need the intent. You can just have accidentally, I picked it up somewhere and accidentally wrote it. I would have thought that would have made it such that you wouldn't even have needed to be proven to have heard it, you know, but I guess you're saying you have to have some link to the original material. But how does that work with stuff like inventions? Like if I invent something and I copyright it, isn't it different? Like, cause I have the copy. If someone happens to invent the same thing the same way, but then they're like, aha, I'm going to sell this. They can't, right?
To give you the shortest possible answer, that's why patent law is different than copyright law.
Oh, okay. Right? Gotcha.
So in copyright, the offense is copying. So some things are presumed copying in the right. Whenever you're talking about intent, right? Like some things are presumed copying if you have, you know, large chunks of text that are identical, right? It is there are numerous cases that are like, you know, look, nobody is going to string together these words in precisely this order, right? The odds, it's why I made the joke of the infinite monkeys, mm-hmm. right? Like the
odds of it
so
happening are
low.
Very low. Okay. Yeah. Makes sense. Yeah,
that we can infer copying. And if not, if you can't prove direct copying, then you prove the combination of one, access to the work, and number two, that they're substantially similar, right? So that's the test. And okay. then we've been talking about, so we're in that area, right, of proving those two things, and the first part is conceded, right? So the access is conceded. Yeah. So now the question is substantial similarity,
so
which then breaks
Led Zeppelin's
into the test
expert
that we
just went up. Now, how do you feel in light of the something and the other songs that have the same exact progression?
Yeah, and that seems to me to be another legal question. Right. And so here I would hope that the lawyers have done a good job of explaining that in copyright, the copyrightable elements have a very low bar for what constitutes protection. So, for example, the seminal case on it is a case called Feist Publications, which means that copyright extends to the parts of work that are created independently. Right. They're not copied from another's work and which contain, quote, minimal creativity, end quote. So in the music area, most basic musical elements are not copyrightable.
Yeah, obviously, because you can't say, I used the A chord already. You can never use the A chord again. You know, like and I would extend that personally, in my opinion, to pretty much any 3-4 chord sequence has been used a bajillion times in every song ever. And I would kind of put this on along those lines.
So that's why this is a neat case. And this gives the potential for the Supreme Court, if they are feeling 70s nostalgic, to intervene, because there's actually an area of uncertainty, right? This is the difference between. So there's a previous Ninth Circuit case called Sversky. OK. And in Sversky, the Ninth Circuit held that. It, pretty much exactly what you just said. I mean, this is really fascinating to me. A single musical note is too small a unit to attract copyright protection. However, an arrangement of a limited number of notes can garner copyright protection.
Yeah, that makes
and
sense.
In Sversky, they said 7 notes is sufficient.
Wow.
Right? So 7 notes in a row is enough.
Well, and the thing is, when you're talking melody, you know, not just the chord structures we're kind of talking about with this, when you're talking melody, the odds of having the same exact notes and timing is pretty low. So like once you get to that number of notes, especially if they're in the same, you know, it's a quarter note here, it's an whatever, the odds do become pretty astronomical that you would have the same thing. But then I'm sure you could also bring in other complications, like with the Vanilla Ice thing where they took the Queen bass line and it's dum 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 dum. And they're like,
that,
no, we added dum 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 dum.
That is my favorite interview of all time. The Vanilla Ice going, now see, mine goes dun 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 dun.
Yeah.
And theirs goes dun 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 dun.
And technically, he's right that he did add a single note there, but it is very easy to just add one note to throw something off, you know, to make something slightly different. So it does seem like it's always going to be a weird gray, you know, human judgment area. Like there's not going to be a mathematical formula that's going to tell you this.
But interestingly, right, the jury instruction, one of the jury instructions that the Ninth Circuit found inappropriate was an instruction that, quote, common musical elements such as descending chromatic scales, arpeggios, or short sequences of 3 notes are not protected by copyright.
Yeah.
And it is pretty clear to me that if I was the juror and I had gotten that instruction, I would be like, well, this is a descending chromatic scale.
Yeah.
And it's 4, right? It's not 3 notes, but it's 4. It's dun, 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 right? Like, so, all right, if 3 is not, 4 is probably not protectable. Okay, not protectable.
And yeah, I would say it's 5, dun, 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 dun. There's 5, the chromatic descending line is 5 notes long that they both follow.
Okay, so that's why this is being, you know, again, if not appealed to the Supreme Court, that's why this will be retried.
Yeah.
Because that particular instruction, when the law is in sort of a gray area, right, the law is very clear. If it's 7 notes, that's sufficient. So The jury instruction. If you was, add well, if it's in three together, notes, it's not enough.
Yeah, but if you add, yeah, if you add in together all the notes of that kind of chord progression, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, you know, there's going to be like 20 something. But it's still so vague. Whenever you're playing that progression, hitting the, you know, I was going to say 1, 3, 5, but since it's guitar, it's often not as logical as that. There's some other, I'll have to figure it out later, the inversion of it. But hitting that kind of arpeggiated thing going descending like that is super common. The idea that that's going to be a ripoff. Anyway, now I wanted to turn this toward you and ask you something, because I have a few other points, but I think they're not, you know, I don't think they're going to change what you're talking about in this, but I do really have a question about what in the end would be the end result of this. Because when I'm looking at this, again, looking at it as a songwriter, as a musician, this song, Taurus by Spirit, is 2 minutes and 39 seconds long, and the guitar does not even start until 40 seconds in. So it is a tiny song, you know, and it's all it is. That's the only similarity. Stairway to Heaven is a literal 8 minute magnum opus with like 75 different parts, you know, and you know, don't get me wrong, Taurus is a lovely little song and all that. It actually branches off to its own really nice chord progression that's totally different than Stairway, and it's nice. But like, this is where I'm curious, and I want to ask you, like, how would the law work if it's ruled to be some sort of copyright infringement? Because, you know, if I were in charge of this, and let's say we even had like the worst case, you know, like Jimmy Page and Robert Plant like broke into the Watergate Hotel and stole this plans to this song or something. Still, even with all of that going on, think of all the different components you've got. You've got that beautiful recorder arrangement I talked about. You've got that top guitar harmonic line. You've got the other 7 minutes of song. You've got drums. You've got lyrics, by the way. Don't forget about a bustle in your hedgerow or whatever the heck. Spirit didn't write that. If there's a bustle in your hedgerow, don't get alarmed now or something. Not only the lyrics, you've got the melody that he's singing, which is a totally different layer on top of that. And honestly, when it comes to popular music, it's usually the vocal melody, maybe the lyrics, that makes songs successful to begin with. So in the end, I want to ask you, like, how will this work? Because if I were somehow in charge, I'd say, like, even if they flat out stole that one little progression, the da-na-na-na-na, I would say, okay, that's like 4% of this song. Like, if it, and what I'm worried you're going to tell me is like, nope, if they copied any part of it, even though it's an 8 minute gigantic, amazing song, and this is a 2 minute thing, 40 seconds of which is like one note on a synthesizer or one note of strings, then it'll be like 50-50. And I'm very curious if you have any answer to that.
So I have an answer and a non-answer, right? Let's start with the answer, right? Which is which goes back to the extrinsic test, right? And that is, a jury has to conclude that the song taken together is substantially similar to the allegedly infringing item, right? And that's entirely up to the jury's subjective determination.
But can they factor in the entire 8 minutes of song, or do they only factor in? That's what I'm wondering. Like, if they only show them the notes of the beginning of Stairway to Heaven, then sure, yeah, it is very similar. But like, there's 8 minutes of Stairway.
I'm gonna read you the language again from the Michael Bolton case, right, which was brought by the Isley brothers, And the test is, this is the intrinsic test. I think I accidentally said extrinsic before. So extrinsic is, you break it down into its components and you look at it. I think we're there. Intrinsic is whether the ordinary reasonable person would find the total concept and feel of the works to be substantially similar.
Okay. Well, hopefully that would be a no. Right? I mean, what do you think? I would, as a juror... Well, or as a music expert, or either, I would hope that I already forget which one you said, but the one that's taking it as a whole, I would hope that would be no.
So that's interesting to me that you feel that way, and maybe I would be in the minority in the jury here, and I would have to be persuaded the other way. I, as not an audio guy, I'm kind of exporting over my knowledge of copyright in in written cases and also in physical cases. And I've litigated cases like this before. And the argument that I would make if I were Randy California's lawyer, I'm sure he made an argument similar to this, is if I have a copyrighted, for example, I litigated a jewelry case, right? And there, the copyright holder was attempting to argue that having three eggs in a bird's nest was the original work. And so anytime you had any jewelry that had three eggs in a bird's nest, it violated her copyright.
Hmm.
And I argued, no, that's crazy, right? That's not copyrightable, that, you know, lots of independent. This is kind of your Beatles something argument, right? That there's not sufficient originality.
I could produce for you, if I were working on this case, 7,000 songs that all have the same thing. And I could just rattle them off one after the other. Here, this one, this one, this one. They all have that chromatic descending line, and the chords are very similar.
Well, I am nominating you on the retrial to serve as an expert witness for Led Zeppelin.
Well,
would be a phenomenal get for us.
I'm sure there are better experts they could find. Are they allowed to introduce into evidence, here's all these other songs that have this?
Yeah.
How does that make you feel as, again, juror number Andrew? How would you react to that? I'm curious.
Well, and I mean, it sort of goes back to where I was, because if you had a truly original work, or it's sort of in contrast to the three eggs case, mm-hmm. right? If you had a truly original work, the idea that you would put other stuff around it, to me, that's not persuasive to me at all, right? I would view that as like if there was a book, if we find next year that, a political pundit has written a book, you know, one of these bestsellers of, you know, what's wrong with the Trump White House. And, you know, when we buy it and we read it and we're like, that's cool. And then suppose chapter 11, like we look at it and are like, well, this seems to be word for word from, you know, our Stormy Daniels is a Legal Genius episode. Like, I'd be really, really mad. And the fact that there are 16 other chapters that are independent would not be enough.
Well, that's why I'm saying, though, at best, that's why I wanted to ask you, like, how the penalties or the percentages, like, how that part is configured. Because I could understand if the facts were super bad and they did just, like, copy this. And again, I will never rule on the side of spirit, because as a musician, I know this is BS and this is a thing you do in songs all the time. There's a billion things like this. I don't find it at all similar enough to be copyright infringement personally. And I'm curious if there's anyone else who like writes songs who feels differently. I don't know. It's just so common to do this progression. We could find so many other. And that's the thing. Take your example. Let's say, okay, chapter 11 is very close word for word to what we said on opening arguments. And then we find there's like 6,000 other blogs, podcasts, other forms of media that have said virtually the same thing in the same words. Then how would you feel?
Well, yeah, but again, that to me, that gets to the question of minimum copyrightable elements, mm-hmm. right? Like that is this more like three eggs in a nest, or is this more like the specific words we put together in a specific order? But to answer your question, and it's why I think this is really, really fascinating. Copyright law it's an either or, right? Like it is, you do not apportion fault. It is just,
that's what I was afraid of. So are they just going to get like 50% of the royalties or something?
Yeah, it would be the statutory damages that, they're seeking in the complaint are $150,000 per infringement.
Well, that's infinite money.
Would exceed the value of the Western Hemisphere at this point. Yeah. Right? Like it's an inconceivably large number.
Well, and that's stupid though, because Led Zeppelin doesn't get $150,000 every time someone plays the song. Like, where's that money coming from?
Nope. But that's what. Right. That's what the copyright law is meant to do, is it's meant to
that's
set
silly
here's why it's not silly. Right. And again, what's a challenge is exporting something into fields that are not analogous. But it's meant for this purpose. Right. Which is I write a novel and it sells 8 copies and I make $12 off of it. And then let's pick a novelist that Let's pick an author that I respect maybe more than any other author out there right now. Then Michael Lewis comes along, finds the thing that I've written and steals it word for word, puts his name on it, and makes $1 billion and gets a, movie deal out of it starring Sandra Bullock. Like, what copyright law wants to do is they do not want.
You're so Michael lucky Lewis. That Sandra Bullock is still working.
Yeah.
Otherwise, that was a fantastic 90s pre-Ally McBeal Andrew reference.
No.
Just happened to work out because
she was in The Blind Side, and I.
Gotcha. Yeah,
that's why I picked that. That was an actual intentional thing. I will not go down the Sandra Bullock rabbit trail. But right, like what we don't want is, and what the authors of copyright law did not want was for Michael Lewis to be incentivized and for other people to be incentivized to troll and steal.
But I was just
copyrighted
saying,
works
okay,
with,
so that
with
they
minimal
still make a nice profit on it. Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
so,
right.
So the idea is to have the freedom to be able to levy gigantic penalties to kind of dissuade people.
Regardless of whether you've suffered any actual harm.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Now, that creates other perverse incentives. And there are, in fact, copyright trolls, the case that I had to litigate, I would describe in that fashion, who go looking for any kind of similarity and then say, okay, we want statutory damages per infringement. And by the way, that is the maximum, right? Like there are...
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can go down to, you know, sort of a reasonable number on statutory damages. But yeah, so the net answer is copyright law is not well suited to split the baby.
Yeah.
And that, you know, as you're not supposed to take that into account as a juror. This is part of why lawyers don't frequently get chosen to sit on juries. But I think that's a strong public policy argument in your favor. So I thought this was super interesting, and I love how clear it is to you as a musician that it was not a copyright violation, because when I play those two, when you started off and you play those two back to back, when you hear Spirit, you're like, oh, okay, this not just
so then again, is the answer that the average person doesn't realize that every song is that, like, you could do that with most songs. Now this one, admittedly, it's a little more similar, as I said, you know, it's the same place on the fretboard, it's voiced pretty much the same way, but like when you if you took the sheet music, if you took the chord progressions and the chord structures of most songs that are popular, you can easily find other songs that have the same thing, because most pop songs are so simple, it's like easier to, you know, there's not as much to them, so it's harder to be super unique in that way. But like, you can find so many examples of this. Is that why maybe I have a different impression of it than you might? I don't know.
I think that is because, again, as a non-musical expert, I would say yes on the extrinsic test, right? When we were breaking down the specific chord progression, you see that relationship, and that relationship is also there with something. But when you play Something, right, like that doesn't sound like Stairway to me, right? But when you play Taurus, right, it
okay, the, but then I, that's going back to what you said at first, which is, oh, you can't just add some stuff on top. The reason Something sounds different to you is because there's other stuff going on that's, you know what I mean? Like, that would seem to contradict what you said earlier, where it's like, oh, you can't just add some notes on top and have it be different. While I do agree with you, Something at its roots, at its the chord progression there is the same. Like I said, until the last chord, which, by the way, is different between Stairway to Heaven and Taurus as well. The last chord is slightly different. So I don't know. To me, it's not. We've gone way too long, though. We gotta try to wrap this up.
No, this is super. This is great. And again, what I would just mention is you have to prove copying. You have to meet both tests, right? So it has to be objectively similar via the extrinsic test, which we agree,
right,
that Taurus, Stairway, and Something are all potentially objectively similar. And then it has to pass that intrinsic test, that feel test of, taken as a whole, does this seem to be, would a reasonable person find the total concept and feel of the works to be substantially
right, and
similar?
That's where I think it should clearly be no. Like, I do agree with you on the first part. There's, you know, there's some similarities to the structure of it, but if you're allowed to take the whole work and feel and what it is, I would hope that it would be an easy no, but that's just me.
Yeah. No, this would be, I wish we were on a jury together. And
the only difference you will be between Something and Stairway in that specific part, which we apparently agree, you can look at just this one part. The only difference is the strumming pattern. That's the only difference. Like, and the idea that would be the difference between copying and not, to me, seems also like it can't be right. You know, if you take the exact chord progression of a famous song, but oh no, I'm gonna do the vanilla. I'm gonna Vanilla Ice it instead of dum 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 dum. It's gonna be da da dum dum dum. You know, like that can't be true. So, all right, well, I guess we're at an impasse there.
Yeah, and again, I'm not saying I can't be persuaded. I just want to give voice to the plaintiff side here. I am super curious what our listeners are going to think.
Yeah, I'm curious too. Maybe I'll be in the vast minority on that. We'll see. All right. Well, concert aside, Andrew, it's time to move on. Like, I could never stop talking about that. I have so many thoughts about the Blurred Lines case. A really interesting Radiohead case that I would love to talk about, but this is not opening chord progressions. It's opening arguments, and it's a legal show, and we got to go move on.
Spin-off podcast. If we get enough interest, we'll do
if there's an update at some point, maybe we come back to it. Maybe we could do another segment someday, but but that was fun. Thanks for indulging me, allowing me to do that. I thought it was a lot of fun to try to put Andrew through the you be the Supreme Court thing that he put me through a while back, which we all enjoyed. So, all right, well, there you have it. It is time to thank our new patrons over at patreon.com/law, who, as I said, I hope are enjoying the Lot Awful movies, and there's going to be plenty of bonus content going forward. Lots of reasons to join. And here are the latest heroes we need to thank. We start with Travis Bailey, Anthony Mullick, Christopher Andrews, Dev T, Alex Macaronis, or Macaronis, maybe, I don't know. My hovercraft is full of eels. And now
I think that's a returning patron. I seem to remember that name.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. And now it's time for TTTBE. No, you almost got me. Brian Melcher, Joanna Souza. Okay, this is an unpronounceable thing. I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's the Icelandic volcano. I think I've heard of that one. It's very hard to pronounce. William Beam. Go ahead, Andrew.
And thank you to Tom Byrne, Bill Garassi, RJ Pawlowski, Jeremy Baramy, Timeline Enthusiast, Pierre Raboul, Jeff Salisbury, Dan Linden, Benjamin Drachman, Ellie Aliotti, and Avery Spiel. Thank you all so much for helping out and for supporting the show. You can head on over to patreon.com/law. Throw us a buck. Come on. You know you want to.
Great, good place reference on the Jeremy Baramy timeline. Highly recommend that show. It's fantastic.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, and it is time to find out if I lucked my way into some TTTBE. This one was really tricky. How did I do?
Well, so to remind all of our listeners, this is question number 105. This was about a car dealership that owed the bank $10,000, and then the dealership sells a car for $10,000 and is going to get paid in $1,000 per month installments from the buyer. And then the car dealership telephones up the bank and says, "Hey, would you take $1,000 a month for 10 months instead of asking for the whole $10,000, which would otherwise be due on June 1st. Bank says yes. And then the dealer says to the buyer, "Hey, look, instead of paying me and making me go through all the money, just pay the bank directly." The car buyer sends the first $1,000 to the bank, and the bank is like, "Get out of here with that." And tells the dealership, "Hey, we want the whole, it's after the due date," which was specified as June 1. "We want the whole thing. Pay it immediately." Dealer says, "No, come on. You agreed to take $1,000 a month. What, you know, knock it off." And then the argument, I like the way this question is framed, because it asks which argument best supports the bank's claim to be able to demand the money up front. Right? So you weren't asked to adjudicate, is the bank going to prevail? It says, what's the best argument for the bank? And you narrowed it down to B and D. So you eliminated A, The agreement to extend the time for payment was not in writing. You correctly identified that as a statute of frauds issue. This is absolutely good elimination. This is absolutely not a statute of frauds kind of case. And so
I doubt I did very well on this one, but at least I got that. At least I identified that.
You eliminated that one. Yeah. You were between B and D. So let's talk about D, which was the dealer's conduct was an attempted novation that the bank could reject. You were like, I don't know what the hell a novation is. So it could be that, but it probably isn't. Correct. It isn't. So novation, okay. You might think the like Latin root, right? Nove, new, right?
Yeah.
A novation is...
It's like innovation,
I'm sorry?
It's like, it sounds like innovation, but with the front chopped off.
Yeah, well, right, because innovation is making a new thing. A novation in contract is when you modify a contract, you bring three people to a contract. So let's do it this way. You and I have a contract, and then I no longer want to do it, so I bring in... Lydia, and I say, hey, Lydia, you're going to take over my obligations to Thomas under this contract. And Thomas, you say, that's fine. I know where Lydia lives. I'm happy with her taking over your obligations. And we then execute an agreement whereby she agrees to take on the responsibilities and you agree to release me from those responsibilities. That's a novation. Here, you don't have that because the bank never had any idea who the car buyer was, right? Hmm. So the this was meant to try and trip you up with that. You were not so tripped up because the car buyer, the dealership is effectively trying to get a novation here by substituting the buyer, but didn't go through that process. So then,
well, but it then that sounds like D would be correct. Then I don't get it. Because the dealer was, in what way is, D says the dealer's conduct was an attempted novation that the bank could reject.
Yeah.
What part of that is wrong?
Let me be clear. This is an end run around a novation, right? Like this is attempting to get the benefits of a novation without trying to comply with the requirements of a novation, right? Does that,
you're saying that's different than...
Right. No lawyer would call this a novation, which is what the question is asking.
Okay.
And the reason you wouldn't call it a novation is because the dealer didn't bring the third party to the table.
Okay.
That's what this is really testing your knowledge of.
That's a tough one. It's almost like if I knew a little more, I would have guessed that, you know, like even though it was wrong, that seems like a tough one to eliminate as a lawyer.
Why do you say that?
Well, if I knew enough to know what a novation was, at least had, maybe I studied it in law school, maybe I remember, I might have thought, oh yeah, this is an attempted novation. And, it just sounds like you have to have a very specific knowledge of what constitutes that to.
Well, and again, I have done novations over my career. It's a not uncommon event. The key is, all of the parties have to come to the table for it to be a novation.
Yeah, but what that didn't so like what I guess where I'm getting tripped up, sorry to dwell on this, but I it is kind of interesting. Not bringing all players to the table would seem to a layperson like, oh, they're trying to do a novation, but without that one component, you know? But like you're saying, because they didn't do that, lawyer.
Yeah, that's the most important component.
Okay. So no lawyer would ever call it that. Right. And that's okay. That seems like a very attractive distractor.
Yeah, I agree. That's what this question wanted you to go for to get it wrong. So that leaves you with B, your answer. The dealer could not delegate its duty to pay the buyer, or C, the dealer gave no consideration for the agreement to extend the time of payment. And I'm sad to tell you, you picked B.
Ooh.
The reason why C is a better answer is that one could imagine a contractual situation in which a party may assign its rights and duties under a contract, right? You can also imagine it being to the contrary. I often write into my contracts for my business clients that the duties may not be assigned without the consent of the other party. In the absence of that, however, contractual duties may be assigned. May be delegated to somebody else. So that's not the best argument. The best argument is when the bank said, yeah, you can give us the $10,000 as $1,000 a month instead of as a $10,000 up front. The bank got nothing in return.
I should have keyed into the without interest in pay. Yeah.
Yep. Having been, and remember, consideration in general, courts will not look to the adequacy of it. So it's why the question was written that way. It's one of the like sneaky things that you want to look for on the bar exam. If the consideration had been minimal, right? If it had been, and they promised that, you know, whatever, right? Some other minimal promise that could be construed as a benefit to the bank, then there would be consideration. But because this was just the bank being nice, going, yeah, well, you could pay the 10 grand. Or, yeah, you want to pay it $1,000? Fine. I don't care. Just give me my money. And then all of a sudden the bank is surprised when you're like, oh, well, when I said pay you $1,000 a month, I meant I was going to have Bob pay you $1,000 a month. Again, as somebody who often represents clients that are in the situation of the bank here, I could see the bank going, look, I didn't sign up for this, and I don't want to have to be chasing down Bob after 6 months. Like, my contract's with you. You owed me the 10 grand. I was trying to be nice. You then did something I didn't expect.
And that sounds exactly like B. The dealer could not delegate its duty to pay the buyer. But you're saying technically the dealer could have maybe, and that's why it's a better...
Yeah, yeah. Okay. The better argument is lack of consideration. Because
interesting.
When I say, fine, but I'm not getting anything out of it, that's a better answer than saying you couldn't
delegate.
It's
a case
because
where there are, in fact, takesies-backsies. Yep.
Yes.
Okay. All that's right. Exactly. That's I got that one wrong. I'm on a bit of a skid here. I'm going downhill fast. Maybe I'm reverting to the mean of 25% that I should be at.
I do not think we're
well. This was even a failure of Thomas's second chance bar exam, which is rare. So all around
those
failure.
Those are rare, but we'll get back in the saddle on the next one.
All right, all around failure. Well, that's the show. Andrew, hop in the time machine. Tell us who won this week's TTTBE.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Well, Thomas, we would have gone with Eric Olson, whose 1L contracts final was last Friday, but he got the right answer and then recanted on Twitter. So we're going to go with The Brevity, who says the answer is C. As Thomas identified and ignored, a little bit of a shot there, the bank's promise was illusory and consideration is the magic word. Also, novation is clearly the forced unpaid time off when your kids don't have school. So congratulations on winning, The Brevity. Everyone give him or her a follow. That is at @_BREVITY, The Brevity on Twitter. And congratulations on being this week's winner.
Well, this was fun. I'm depressed about the bar, but, you know, hopefully I can get back on a winning record here. But thanks for listening. That was a lot of fun. I'm very curious what people think about the Spirit Led Zeppelin lawsuit. I imagine there will be I imagine there's going to be arguments on both sides of this one. I feel like there are a lot of people who hate Led Zeppelin who kind of want to take them down.
Can we both agree those people are wrong?
I love Led Zeppelin. I think their lyrics are often incredibly stupid and hard to listen to, but everything else is 10 out of 10. Like, there's the bass playing, the drumming, the guitar, the singing. It's all just amazing. They're like one of the most talented groups ever, I think. But the lyrics are kind of silly.
I think that's fair. But I would endorse all of that, and I don't know that I need to argue with you over lyrics. It was, you know, it was the 60s, it was the 70s. Come on, man.
I enjoy them. I've listened to pretty much every Led Zeppelin song at one point or another. I do enjoy the band. They're very talented. Okay, we agree on that. We unite. We don't have to bring up the divisive grunge rock issue. We'll just agree on Led Zeppelin, and we'll say see you guys for a Rapid Response Friday.
Can't wait.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at OpenArgs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.